Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to a Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 14th of December. I'm Phil Carroll.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
11 days. 11 days to Christmas. 11, Kev.
And yeah, though we're recording this on Friday, on Saturday I've got 3 Christmas parties, followed by another 2 next week and then another 2 around Christmas. And then I'm going to the North Coast. Hallelujah. The Mediterranean.
Shut down. Christmas shut down. You're going to have a couple of weeks off?
Yeah, we're recording a whole load of stuff, as I've said to you, this coming week and the next week. And then, hopefully have 10 days of just family, because I feel like I've been in this office and on my own for quite a while now.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's not a bad thing, being on your own. I mean, just coming on to the news story in the UK that NHS being under severe strain as this super flu H3N2 outbreak drives record hospitalizations, with hospitals declaring critical incidents and some schools closing, prompting urgent calls for vaccination and reinstated mass measures. The H3N2 flu strain, specifically called subclade K, is causing a big surge in both UK and the US right now. In the UK, hospital admissions have jumped by over 50% in just a week, and some hospitals are bringing back mask rules while encouraging vaccinations. They're also facing a planned doctor's strike as well, which might make things tougher. In the US, the same flu variant is driving up hospital cases, and public health officials are really pushing for people to get their flu shots and take precautions. Both countries are basically ramping up their vaccination campaigns to keep this flu wave in check. So I don't know. I know you got something flawed with something about 2 or 3 weeks ago, didn't you?
Yeah.
But I don't know what this is trying. I know a few people who've had it in the UK, and apparently it is really, you know, it's not your average man flu. This is debilitating.
Yeah, no, I just had a message from someone saying they've got the man flu and they were not happy. I was at church last night and I think there was 10 people there, and normally it's like 40, 50 people in the congregation. So it's spread wild here as well in Egypt. So it's like, it's not good.
Absolutely.
I mean, is this any different than COVID? I don't think so. Ultimately, I think but for sure the governments can't afford to shut down. They shouldn't have shut down last time. Hopefully they're going to learn their lessons. You know, we've got to sort of take it on the chin. If people are unwell, they're unwell. And I hope it's not you or me or anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I do tend to like not go to too busy places, around, you know what I mean? Like sort of cafes, restaurants and that, and try and stay away this just before Christmas, because the worst thing you can do is come down with something. I've had it before over the Christmas period and it's just not fun. So try and sort of keep away more outdoor spaces.
Yeah. If this happens, we're going to be in a situation where we've just, the numbers came out on Friday that the economy shrank. Well, it's going to do it again if we have this flu situation.
Definitely. And then did you see the news? I mean, this is a big one, isn't it? We talk about football quite a lot, but obviously the 2026 World Cup being held in the US, Canada and Mexico, ticket prices have sparked a lot of frustration. Some fan groups like Football Supporters Europe are calling the prices extortionate, because following a team from the group stage all the way to the final could run into the cost of about $7,000, almost 5 times the cost of the 2022 Qatar tournament. For England fans, even just group stage tickets are starting around £165, and the total for a final might run up to top £5,000. This is all down, Kev, we've talked about it, you know, FIFA's dynamic pricing, where ticket costs change based on how attractive a match is, and making things even more unpredictable, and has led to accusations that the spirit of the World Cup is being lost. As a result, fan groups are pushing FIFA to rethink the pricing to keep the tournament accessible. I mean, we had a bit of a chat about this on Charles's group, didn't we? I think Joel was saying that he's priced it up for his son, and to do the whole of the group stages would cost him, with flights, would cost him something in the region of about €20,000. I mean, that's extortionate, isn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, and it's pricing out, as he said, the fans, the real diehards who go there to all the away games into Europe, you know, that were there at the Euros, are not going to be there. And it's going to become like this corporate type affair, isn't it?
Oh, for Gunapuma, that's the weekend out. What are you talking about? No. That was a joke, Joel. Anyway, the scenario is, yes, it's ridiculous. Are we surprised? It's in the US. Basically, if you have a couple of ounces of gold, you might be able to go. If you have some of those greenback things that they keep printing more and more and more of, then yeah. I think the prices are comparable, the cheaper prices anyway, because some of the more expensive ones are ridiculous, but the cheaper ones are comparable with NFL games.
Yes,
Okay.
I said that. I mean, Super Bowl tickets are extortionate at the final, which is, but you imagine, right? If FIFA are pricing them at sort of 3,000, the final is $3,000. What are the tickets going to look like on the black market, on the tout market? You can add at least 4 or 5x onto that. We're talking probably $15,000 to $20,000 for a final ticket.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It's basically become the rich man's game in terms of that. But we haven't really seen any difference in that in terms of the Premier League, because the Premier League's the same, isn't it? If I want to take my son to a Premier League game now at Anfield, one, it's very, very difficult for me to get a ticket. So more than likely, I'm going to have to go into hospitality. I'm going to probably have to pay between 300 and 500 quid for each of us, and that's the way it is. If I can actually get a ticket, it would probably be 150 to 200 quid for two of us to go. If I need to do hospitality, then it's going to be anything from 600 to 1,000 quid. And hospitality, what you get a meal and you get a few drinks if you want them, and you get a program thrown in and you get a nice seat. But that's about it, isn't it? I mean, for that experience, it is becoming, for rich people. And I think the points that were being made in the group were that, the real staunch England fans, the followers, they're in the main working class people, and they want to go and support England all over the world. I'm not saying they're not going to be able to afford it, because they'll try and afford it, but it's getting a bit ridiculous, isn't it?
I mean, if you look at the mad part is that you look at the actual allocation details of the tickets for England Croatia game. There's about 2,000 value, what they call Cat 3 tickets, and 1,000 Cat 1, Cat 2, which means there's a roughly 4,000 tickets for that match. Now, in a stadium that seats around 70,000 to 80,000 people, how can it be fair that the England fans only get 4,000 tickets for that match? You know what I mean? Like, it should be almost half and half, or at least 20,000, 20,000, 20 England, 20,000 Croatia, and the rest for hospitality, diplomats, whoever, people associated with the game and FIFA. But like, to only give them 5% of the ticket allocation seems really, really tight.
Yeah, but you know damn rightly there'll be 10,000 England fans in that stadium. So, and how they get them, they're going to pay for them through the nose for sure. But yeah, then I doubt they're going to rethink. And the funny thing is that the percentage of take from the ticket sales in this particular situation is still not nominal, but it's probably only about 20% of the total take of the World Cup. They will be making huge amounts on advertisement in terms of who's sponsoring the thing more than anything else, you would imagine, because that's the way most of these tournaments work.
There's a lot of big sponsors in the Bank of America, McDonald's, Anheuser-Busch, which I think InBev, which is the Budweiser and Michelob, Dove Men Care, Verizon. I mean, look at the
It's not
sponsors.
Coca-Cola a sponsor as usual.
No, not that I can. Yeah, Coca-Cola are the FIFA global partners, but the World Cup specific ones. I think Adidas is the balls, or they make the balls. Aramco, I mean, they're massive. Obviously, there's a big sponsorship there for Formula One as well, and Lenovo. But yeah, big names there for sponsorship, but also the TV rights as well, Kev, for the you know the even for BBC ITV and all the television rights that they sell around the world. So yeah. But I think we've done enough news there. Let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Charles Ray, Chairman, and Simon Rollason, CEO of Aterion. Welcome back to the podcast, gents. How's life?
Good. Thank you for having us.
Good to be back. It's been a while, isn't it?
It's been a while, yeah. The company has signed binding heads of terms for a transformational AI-driven earning joint venture with Paris-based Lithosquare, which will fully fund up to 1.4 million euros of accelerated exploration across eight priority copper and critical mineral projects, covering 2,898 square kilometers in Morocco and Botswana. Lithosquare will deploy advanced geological AI, geophysics, mapping, and scout drilling under an initial €500,000 program, followed by €900,000 of drilling on successful targets, earning an initial 20% interest and 0.5% net smelter royalty, with scope to increase to 49.9% equity and 2% NSR, strictly based on value creation milestones. The structure enables zero dilution for Eterian shareholders, whilst fast-tracking multiple licenses simultaneously, establishing Eterian as one of Africa's first exploration groups to apply AI at scale across entire copper belts, with partners already mobilized and work underway. So this joint venture is being described as transformational for Eterian. What was the catalyst for partnering with an AI-powered exploration company like Lithosquare, and how quickly do you expect this technology to start redefining your exploration pipeline?
I think strategically that we recognized quite some time ago that we had a large portfolio of exploration projects. And while the Rio Tinto transaction was a great, let's call it a test of our capability to engage with a large major and execute a partnership and a program, and that, so to fulfill all the due diligence requirements, all of the necessary work programs, et cetera, we recognized that we needed to dramatically expand on the execution. And so with AI, we feel that we can explore across this vast portfolio in a different sort of way. And then it allows us to create those targets so that Simon and his team can get on the ground and start drilling. And so strategically, we recognized quite some time ago we needed to do something like this. It's just taken quite a bit longer than we expected or anticipated to get the deal done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people may never have heard of Lithosquare. I certainly hadn't. I mean, the only broadly comparable company I can kind of find was, is it Cobalt Metals? But obviously, they've got a giant funding base from investors like the Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Breakthrough Energy Ventures. So just talk us through, how you were introduced to Lithosquare, what they're going to bring. Obviously, they're going to bring, as you mentioned, the expertise to look at the advanced data science sets and foundational AI. But how are they going to really help Eterian going forward?
Yeah, I'll let Simon speak to more about their capabilities. I'll say that we were introduced to them through our board of directors. So we have a number of board members who are familiar with the management team and had been in discussions with the management team for various projects relating to either companies they were associated with outside of Eterian or projects they were associated with. And as you know, a large part of our portfolios come from the Elemental Altus, which is now Elemental Royalties. And so there were a number of people there who are either in management there or were in management there who have been working with a number of different AI companies. So that kind of kicked off the introductions and the discussions. And then it was really about formulating the right sort of plan that we where they were invested, they were spending capital, and they had all the right incentives to make these assets as valuable as possible.
I think what's also attractive, Charles, is just the fact that they have a strong geoscience team behind them. So, it allows you to bounce ideas back and forth. What we're kind of hoping for is that with the AI sort of side of thing, but also with their geoscience team, is work our way through to getting to these drill targets as quick as possible. I mean, in Morocco, we have a number of projects where we already have a sense of where we think we should be drilling, but it's using the other teams or the joint venture partner skill set to improve on that targeting so we can get out there and sort of get well-located drill holes based on geology and multiple layers of science behind it.
Yeah. And it said, I alluded to then at the top there that Lithir Square can earn up to 49.9% and a 2% net smelter royalty, but only through these measurable exploration successes. So, what specific milestones or value creation with triggers will determine how much interest they earn, and how are you aligning incentives on both sides?
I think the key ones here are being able to demonstrate through initial drilling, the scout drilling, that there is something potentially of economic scale within a project. So that could be a drill meter over a certain interval at a certain average grade. Each project is slightly different, so we have to sort of work our way through that. And then really the key ones that I think are the real driver for this is like moving it forward from that point onto the potential to generate an inferred mineral resource estimate. That's a key driver. And then the last one would be, if the stars all align and we can get to the point where we can have a sort of preliminary, say, feasibility study produced that has some economics attached to it, and then it really sort of that would then really move the company forwards.
Very good. So how are they going to be using AI in a way that is going to benefit both themselves and the company? I mean, I did a little bit of reading up, and it seems to be that till this point they've been very desk-based, and now this is their sort of active move onto the ground exploration.
That's right. And what they have is they have the computational capability to analyze and assess large swaths of geophysical data. Again, I'm not the geologist, so I'm going to pass it over to my colleague and long-suffering friend Simon to discuss this. But what I was most impressed with was some of the work that they had done in the past with the French government. And so, and it, and what I, from what I've been told, that capability and that skill set demonstrates quite a bit of analysis and data crunching. And so, yeah, again, I'll pass it over to Simon.
Well, I think with all these things in the AI process, it's basically, put garbage in to get garbage out. And the challenge with all AI platforms that other companies may be sort of using and implementing is that, you need to have good data at the early stage. And typically in early stage exploration, you don't have that level of information. But I think, where we're operating, particularly in Morocco, there are quite a number of useful data sets that are available through the geological survey equivalent in Morocco that we can then put into the system to allow us to fine-tune the model. Because this is not a case of here's a company with an AI platform that's targeting the mineral sector. This is a company that's developing the AI platform, and they will be refining that model as we progress through the whole sort of partnership. And the initial steps that we're looking at now is to get onto the ground again and do some targeted exploration that we feel best would fit into the AI platform to allow the modeling for the drill targets. And hopefully that would then build up an electronic fingerprint, as you would, that would allow us then to go onto other projects. But also, the information that you get from this will be quite valuable because it'll give you a view of the concepts of the mineralized system that occur within the country. It could be the sedimentary copper in Morocco. And that would maybe potentially allow us then to say, well, maybe we should be looking in this particular area. Or in Botswana, it's the same. Should we be drilling over here, or should we look at the data that we've got and maybe adjust ourselves and move to another part of the belt? Yeah, these are all things that are going to come up. And at the moment, it's very much, what ifs sort of scenarios.
Well, the AI models tend to learn, right? So, like the thing is, if you were just to plug in any data set that you get generate from geophysics, things like ChatGPT or Claude or any general AI model, it has too many parameters to go on, so it won't be specific enough. I'm imagining what their AI platform does is it has a limited data set that it works within, and then obviously you then it'll spit out basically these are the targets you want to go after. This is what's the most profitable. And then if you hit, it refines itself. And if you don't, it refines itself based on the feedback and it'll get better and better. Is that the idea?
That's the idea.
I think that's fair comment. But the good thing here is that it's very much an iterative process. And so as you're putting layers of information in, Lithir Square has their own geological team who can interpret the data on the hoof, so to speak. And I think that's quite important because that allows for better resolution and refining of any drill targets that they sort of indicate.
So Simon, the assets that you're talking about, the licenses, the eight licenses, which licenses are they that they're going to be looking at? in Morocco and Botswana?
I think we have a fair idea of what they would be looking at, but what we've done is we've left it quite open to them. They've got the data from the two jurisdictions, Morocco and Botswana, and we've said to them, look at the information over the next 2 months or so, and then target the areas that you, from your initial work, would be the most prospective. So we have a fair view in Botswana of what we think are the prime areas within the Kalahari Copperbelt to focus on, and also in Morocco. But it's kind of letting a third party have another view on the data and the information and see if it sort of verifies and they come up with the same sort of conclusions that we have about priority of the licenses and how we should sort of rank them in terms of prospectivity.
Okay, so in a couple of months' time, you expect to have a rank or a priority, if you like, for these 8 licenses, and then know where you're going to be going after that.
Yeah, most certainly. I don't think it would even take that long, to be honest. And we know in Morocco what we think are the key ones to go on, and those are the ones that we've done the most work on. So it'd be quite interesting to see how they progress through taking these projects that we have a lot of information on, and how they extrapolate that out to less explored projects that we've got.
Be quite interesting if you could find a good silver asset, considering what's looking like happening in the silver market.
Yeah, no, exactly. And Morocco's not a bad place to be exploring for silver. There's a few
Yeah,
sort of success
very good.
stories there, like at Aya.
Historically, there's a lot of silver in Morocco. So the finances, then, coming back to you, Charles, is 1.4 million euros. How is that distributed? Does some money come straight into Aterian?
Yeah.
And is some money going to be used for the money on the ground, if you like, the geology?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I like to do is I like to think that the 1.4 million, which represents a 20% stake in the equity and a half of 1% smelter royalty, does indicate that it's about a 7 million euro valuation for these particular 8 assets. So we're pleased with that as a first step. But the way it works is it's staged. So the first half a million comes in. Tyrion gets an element of that just for operational purposes. We have about 100,000 euros of that we need to spend to complete some of the geophysical work to make sure the data sets are sound and absolutely complete for them. They will be spending approximately 200,000 euros right from the get-go on the ground to complete things like drilling and doing some preliminary exploration. And that half a million euros should allow us to get to, as Simon said, those more refined drill targets sometime over the next couple months. Once that happens, it's iterative. So in other words, there may be an indication that there's 8 unbelievable assets, and that would be wonderful from our standpoint. It's more likely that to indicate there's 4 or 3 or some lesser number. So what's good about this is we have the flexibility to spend that balance, that 900,000 euros, have it directed at the value proposition. So we can spend it across 3 licenses, 8 licenses, 4 licenses. It's really down to us and what we see as the potential. So if there's something that needs money spent on it, this allows us that flexibility to really allocate it to where it belongs.
Very good. Give us an overview then of where Aterian is. You've got these 8 licenses, you've got this joint venture, you've got what's going on in Rwanda, where you've got all the information now from the JV that's no longer, and you've got the trading arm. What else have you got? And
Well, Simon and
explain
I,
in more detail about that so everybody understands.
yeah, Simon and I just came back from Rwanda with a very good week there. What we were working on is expanding and growing the trading business, but as well to look at potential partners with respect to the HCK asset. So discussions are always underway with us and partners. Just to make that clear, this is not anything that I would consider news or insider information. We are always talking to mostly very professional people in the industry who are looking to explore and to develop assets. So that was a very positive trip. We have what I'd call 4 legs to this table. We have the trading business, which we're happy with how that's progressing. It got off to a late start. It got off to a relatively slow start, but that is now consuming a good amount of capital, and we want it to consume more and on a regular basis. And then we have the other three legs, which I would describe as the exploration legs in Botswana, Morocco, and Rwanda. And with this Lithosquare JV, we've allocated capital and resources to developing out those top two, those top assets in Botswana and Morocco. And so really it's just about getting back to Rwanda and making sure either we have exploration partners or and or development partners. Because what we're seeing is there is, you know, from that mining week, there's a lot of positive noise about the lithium potential in Rwanda. There was an indication, I believe, from the likes of Rio Tinto that it is a lithium province. However, from their standpoint, it may not have any one singular asset that meets their scale requirement, but they're still investigating. They're still looking at that. That people having recognized and seen that that's the type of conclusion that a major's come to are starting to come in and look to exploit it for both the tantalum resources, but also the lithium spodumene.
And we've
So,
just completed a small field program up on the Suapan in northern Botswana, where we have those potential lithium brine licenses. So hopefully in 2, 3 weeks' time, we'll get some preliminary results back from the brine samples that were collected from existing wells within the area, and also some auger holes that we put in closer to the edge of the pan itself. So that'd be quite interesting. You know, with this Lithosquare JV, we've really sort of focused ourselves on the Kalahari Copper Belt and the copper silver properties. But you never know, you know, we'll see what the results come back from the lithium brine sampling, and that may be a project that they would take up. You know, and Charles, like you said, in Rwanda when we were down there last week, it's now just putting together some programs for work on some of the licenses that we've got down there. So picking up where Rio left off. And you know, when we went into the Rio agreement in the first place, we kind of sort of said to ourselves, you know, what was the downside, what was the upside? And we always knew that there was a possibility that, you know, it wouldn't go through to a mining stage because of the scale of the deposit that Rio requires, being a tier one company. But it was then, what are the options left for us? And I think it's basically we can do the exploration ourselves, we can still find partners. And that's on the lithium front, but we also have the upper horizons where we have the tantalum niobium material, which we would like to sort of do some evaluation on, and that would provide material that we could then feed through into our trading company. So, you know, as a company, there's a lot on the go at the moment. And I think, you know, the additional cash injection coming from Lithosquare is going to be very, very useful for us going forwards over the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
I mean, the structure of the JV with Lithosquare itself is actually quite interesting because it seems, from their perspective, not from yours, it's quite a high risk, high reward, isn't it? They're putting a significant amount of capital in, but then the potential returns is up to a 2% net smelter and then almost 50% equity in the assets. So if they find what you're looking for, then everybody wins. And if they don't, then you get a lot of data and they take the risk. Would you say that's fair?
I think it's fair, but I also think they're going to be learning quite a bit from this.
I
And
suppose, yeah, for themselves.
Well,
Yeah, and so they.
if they can walk away, let's say if they walked away after sort of 9, 12 months because they felt that they couldn't quite find on the ground what they're looking for in terms of scale or size, you know, they may be in the position where it sort of identifies mineralization. They would have developed a enhanced AI model, and I think that would have tremendous value for them.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to create a large language model for geology going forward, which ultimately is what they're obviously trying to achieve. And by paying this in AI terms, this small amount of money, that's obviously going to have a very good effect on them. Now, if they do find something that is sort of sizable or something that they want to go after, what are we then going to do? Are they going to have access to funds as well as you? I come back to this thing that we've talked about before, Charles, and I think the market's missed it completely, that you are partially owned by Altus. Who owns 50% of Altus now?
Someone with a whole lot of money. So, yes, We recognize that there's some shareholders or ultimate beneficial owners of Ethereum that have a tremendous amount of capital to deploy, and we're trying to stay focused, and we no, it's not trying. We are staying focused on exactly what we're supposed to be doing, which is the trading and the exploration. That being said, we have started having those discussions via the board with our shareholders to see how we can develop those relationships and to take them forward. One of the, as we mentioned right at the beginning, Lithosquare was introduced to us by the board. And what we've discovered is that, one, they have a significantly higher valuation than we do. They are a private company. They are backed by a number of private equity firms. We've started having some discussions with those private equity firms and have been unbelievably impressed with the way they approach risk. And it's something we don't see on the London Stock Exchange at the moment. What we do, or what we have, I think at this very early stage, what we recognize is, generally speaking, Lithosquare has two types of investors. They have the private equity investor that's interested in data, AI, software as a service, those sorts of investors. And then they have the type of investor that's interested in mineral resources and discovery.
The critical
And
minerals.
exactly. And so that is allowing us, one, to broaden our pool of potential contacts in terms of resources, and to so if we do find something, I'm curious to see the reaction from the likes of the Lithosquare audience as a relative to the LSE audience.
Yeah, I mean, the Altus half owned by, is it Ripple now?
No, it's not Ripple. It's another group that deals with US dollar and basically real world assets. So the group is called, oh my
Tether.
goodness, now it's the moment. Thank you, Tether.
Tether, yeah.
Yes. And so generally speaking, what they do is they take US dollar assets. No, they take US dollar currency and allow it to be transformed into cryptocurrencies
Yeah,
or
and they've also
Europe.
been the biggest purchaser of gold in recent times as well.
Investment in
Yes.
mining companies, absolutely, yeah.
And that's part of the reason for the appeal from the likes of Elemental Royalties, as they have a huge portfolio of gold assets that are paying royalties.
Very good. And one last question for me then. What can we expect in 2026 from the trading update?
We can expect in 2026, that the volumes will increase significantly from 2025. As a matter of fact, depending, we have to have meetings with our auditors and accountants to see how much of the volume we can recognize in 2025. So that may be a bit of a me coming back to you with an accounting trick. But the fact of the matter is the trading business is growing. The trading business is, it's been profitable to date. We fully believe in the trading business and think that, one, we can distinguish ourselves because we have an excellent compliance and traceability system in place. And so what we're finding is that when we were down there trying to make sales to new counterparties or engage in supply relationships with new counterparties, there was a value assigned to the fact that we are a listed company, that we do have rules and regulations that we abide by, that we have a tremendous amount of transparency, and that we're employing traceability systems that are new. We're looking into some traceability systems presently that involve a blockchain. And so this is not anything that, these aren't new terms, but they are going to, we believe, allow us to broaden the business and make larger and larger supplies to people all over the world, not just China.
Very good. So, Simon, do you imagine that this deal is going to create a sea change in how we get more and more information to see these eight licenses move forward pretty fast?
That would be the best of outcomes. We want to get onto the ground, and we want to be able to get to that position where we have well-located draw plans and draw locations, because at the end of the day, you can walk around on the surface and bang the rocks and dig trenches until the cows come home, but you need to get some holes in the ground to really appreciate the value of what you have. And it's never going to be just one hole. You need a couple of good intersections to start to understand what you have. We did a little bit of scout drilling in the past at Agdez, the copper silver project that we've got in Morocco, but that was very widely spaced. So hopefully, with a bit of sort of processing of the data that we've got, we can sort of maybe start to look about drilling along strike and down dip of that particular project, and then say another one in Morocco, Azra. We've got a structurally controlled copper gold target. So, one of the things that we want to do now is run some geophysics across that, because it's structurally controlled, and see if the magnetics will help to define the structure of these targets and get on and drill it.
Okay, well, thanks for the updates. It's great to have you back on again. We'll say Charles Bray and Simon Rollison of Aterian, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's hope we hear from you a lot sooner this time.
Yeah, we look forward to that.
So let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Mark Sale and James Knowles from First Class Metals. Welcome back, gents. It's been a while.
Hi, Phil. Yeah, been a while. Good to catch up, though.
Absolutely.
Hi, Kev. Hi, Phil. Yeah, good to see you both again.
Absolutely. Have you guys been on holiday or just been working extremely hard behind the scenes?
I've been out to Canada almost every month this year, and they certainly haven't been a holiday. The last one was particularly arduous when I went out there for the drill program in the cold and the snow.
Absolutely. We've seen quite a lot of news. I mean, let's start in with the latest news. The company's been making strong operational progress at its North Hemlo project, where drilling on the Dead Otter trend has already delivered 9 holes across 4 priority target areas. Around 200 samples are now at the Thunder Bay lab, with drilling set to restart next week to complete the maiden program. Early logging shows multiple structures, veining and sulfides consistent with FCM's exploration model, and despite tough winter conditions, the team has kept things on schedule. With assay results expected in the new year, North Hemlo sits in a district buzzing with renewed interest following the $1.09 billion sale of the Hemlo mine next door. Tell us more, please, Mark, on this.
Yes, we've done 9 holes of the program. We've still got some holes left to do. So far, I was only there for the first few holes, to be honest, Phil. However, what I did see and what I've seen subsequently from the photos, some of which James has been very diligent on putting on the web, and we included some in RNS, certainly we're quite enthused, shall we say, as in regard to the visual we're getting on the cores. There's deformation, there's silicification, there's sulfides, there's quartz veining. So we've got all the earmarks of a mineralized system, but obviously the assays will tell the final word.
So North Hemlo, Dead Otter Trend, Mark. First question, may seem a strange question. Why on earth is it called Dead Otter? Seems a bit unfair on otters.
Well, we're quite fortunate actually, because the lake next door is called the Little Dead Otter Lake. So
There's
be
your
grateful for
answer.
small mercies. We didn't name it. The lake's been called that for time immemorial, I guess, possibly by the First Nations initially. And there's a showing in that area by Chavin in 1980, I think it was. And that's the historic Dead Otter showing. So we
Okay.
can't change the name as much as we'd like to. Somebody suggested we changed it to Deaf Otter, which might have been better than it's only one letter. But no, it's a name we've inherited. And yes, we shouldn't name prospects after animals, lakes, or rivers, or even birds. So.
So to explain, this is a 3.5 kilometer strike length, and you have basically suggested there are now 4 high priority targets. So, and obviously one of them is where the grout sample of 19.8 grams per ton was found. So what are we actually doing at each one of those targets in terms of drilling? How many holes are going in? How many meters? How deep are you going? What angle are you going in at? Et cetera, et cetera.
We've drilled up to 4 holes on a specific target, 4 being on the Dead Otter, sorry, the 19 grammer. Then on other targets, we've drilled 1 or 2 holes. Normally, the second hole is either a 25 meter step back to the first, or if we've drilled the first hole at 45 degrees, then the second hole was off the same drill pad at 70 degrees. So on most of them, we've drilled two. On one, we just drilled one. Unfortunately, owing to the system of assessment in Ontario, which has changed over the recent years, it used to be that you could spread money off one claim to contiguous claims. They've changed it so you can only spread $50,000 as a maximum off a claim into other claims. So we picked four areas where we'd stripped because of the geochemistry, but it was also fortunate that they're on four different claims. Otherwise, we could have spent, we're not sure what the final cost will be of this program, but let's say 300,000. We could have spent 300,000 and only been able to move 100,000 of that off two claims. So, and then we would have been faced with having spent enough money to keep the whole property in good standing, but not being able to do so because of the rules. I mean, I can understand why the rules are what they are. They don't want people to hold on vast areas of ground, having only worked a small part of it. But it seems a little bit unfair when you actually do the work. You've got a 3 kilometer trend, and if you don't spend money all the way along that 3 kilometers, then potentially you could lose it.
Okay, so you've now spent enough on each claim?
The claims, when we submit the assessment report on the drilling, the claims will be good through next year.
Okay, very good. So tell me geologically, what do we think this strike is? What is the reason why we think there's gold in this particular strike?
Well, it's open. We say 3.5 kilometers. But it doesn't stop at the 3.5 kilometers. I'll give Darren a plug. It potentially goes on to Darren's Dotted Lake property to the northwest. We haven't explored it to the northwest, obviously, because it goes potentially it trends off our property, and the same to the southeast. It would go on to what was the Hemlo Explorers property. Now, of course, it's the Hemlo Gold Corporation, who are our neighbours. So, a figure of 3.5 kilometres is just what's contained within a property. I mean, we were at Resourcing Tomorrow recently, and somebody said, "Well, that's not very big." I said, "Well, you could fit two Hemlo gold mines in it. Is that big enough for you?"
Yeah, I don't think it's small, is it really? And you've got to go down as well, so it's not like exactly irrelevant. So that was actually my next point. So Barrick has basically now sold all of its assets off to this Hemlo Mining Corporation for just over $1 billion, and you guys are basically contiguous to this in terms of your licenses. So have you had any communications with these guys? Are they going to send you a check for $500 million, or is that too easy? Too soon to say.
We're not putting the bar that low.
We've been in touch with them, Kevin. We've made early connections, and we'll have conversations when the time's right in the future.
Okay. So what is relevant then geologically on their land that is going to show through to your land, if you like? So in other words, have they found a strike that they know that effectively it's almost certain it's going to continue into your land?
Hemlo Explorers did a 10,000 meter drill program on the ground to the south, contiguous to our property. Hemlo Explorers changed their name to Rocky Shore Gold and moved over to Labrador, I think it was. And then Barrick Hemlo had an option over their property, which they exercised before the sale to Hemlo Gold Corp. So that's how come we now contiguous to the Hemlo mine, shall we say. The Hemlo Explorers drilling program was a follow-up to a previous drill program, which had I think it was a 32 gram, seems to ring a bell, about an ounce in one of the drill intersections, quite deep. They did the 10,000 meter drill program following up on that, but the results were a little bit disappointing from memory. So there is there has been work on potential continuations off our property, but not I wouldn't think in the last couple of years, James, that I'm aware
No,
of.
not
Certainly
that
nothing
trend
published.
below. No, I think Hemlo Mining put a new presentation out last week. They focused interest again on the area, so it was quite positive to see that they're actually looking at the wider exploration portfolio, which I'm quite sure, as Marcus suggested, it's not really been in focus this last few years.
The other thing too, James quite rightly pointed out, they put out a presentation and it was either erroneous or an unfortunate duplication of names, because on the Hemlo map, immediately south of the property, they had a dotted lake and also a dead otter prospect. So, as I say, I don't know whether it's an unfortunate duplication of names or whether it was
Well, you haven't told us that you sold it for $750 million and that's about to
a.
be announced. Is that the reality?
That might be price sensitive. I think we might have to put out a press release.
Okay, listen, from the point of view of just quickly going through your other assets, what's happening with Zigzag, if anything?
Very little at the moment. I had hoped before the winter to get up there to take a bulk sample to do this benefaction, but the winter closed in on us. That's potentially the next thing on the cards, is to do this metallurgical study in the new year. Other than that, I really can't see how I can justify spending money on a lithium project when the lithium price is still suffering, shall we say, and the gold price is becoming stable over 4,000.
Yeah,
So our
absolutely.
focus won't be on Zigzag, it will be on North Hemlo and Sunbeam.
So Zigzag will have its day, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean
Absolutely.
Zigzag's neighbour, Green Technology Metals, are still pushing on with the Seymour Lake facility. So the big player in that belt is still very much pushing forward a major project. So in its day, Zigzag will have its time, I'm sure, but it's possibly just not at this moment for value wise.
The other one is obviously you mentioned Sunbeam, but let's come back to that in a minute. Is this Kerr's Gold? You have an inferred 386,000 ounces on that, and you mentioned the neurology of all of these things as well in terms of Hemlo and Reef, Seymour Lake for all of your assets. But is anything happening with Kerr's Gold? It seems like that's potentially, a company maker as well as the North Hemlo.
Yeah, the Kerr's Gold project. I was looking at the results only recently, Kevin. I think we have to bear in mind it's 386,000 ounces. It's all inferred, which is the lowest level of confidence for a compliant resource. However, and that's at 1 gram with a half gram cutoff from memory. But if you look at the 188,000, so just shy of 200,000 ounces, if you look at that, it's at 3 grams with a 2 gram cutoff. Now we're starting to get them somewhere. I mean, it wouldn't take much to bolster that to be a mineable width and a mineable grade. So what we want to focus on with Kerr's is revisiting the resource to see where the high grade shoots are and see if we can high grade it. Okay, initially we'd drop down the ounces, but it would make it a far more attractive project going forward.
Yeah, I mean, three grams with a 2 gram cutoff is the 2 gram cutoff is pretty severe in terms of the price of gold now and the accessibility in terms of the value thing going on there.
What I think that shows is it's quite a robust core deposit, shall we say. In other words, okay, it's inferred, but I don't think it would be take much to move that higher grade core area up to indicated and possibly measured.
Very good. So, from the point of view of Sunbeam, then tell us where we're at with Sunbeam.
We've been quietly moving forward in the background of Sunbeam. We did put a press release out a wee while ago about the work we'd done there, and it's all completed now. We've got all the results back. We still haven't got the final interp of the VLF, the very low frequency ground geophysics and magnetic, well, VLF and magnetic, sorry, that we did on the property. We've got the initial interp of that, and there's some very strong conductors being shown on the property. We took 500 soil samples in an area to the northeast of Roy, which is one of the historic developments. And again, that's shown quite a robust trend. We want to put it all together when we get the LIDAR interpretation back. There's a company in Australia conducting that at the moment. And what I feel is happening at Sunbeam, just quickly in a low grade technology explanation, is we've got these very strong regional northeast lineaments, three of them, Roy, Pettigrew, and Sunbeam on the property. Each one of them has a named historic development on them, so each one has proven gold potential on it. These are 10 to 15 kilometers long, each one of them, and you've got along those lineaments, shall we say, sporadic. I recently explained it like pearls on a string of hot spots of gold. At the moment, the theory we're working on is that you've got a second structure coming from the west northwest or even the north northwest intersecting those main lineaments, and it's where those two intersect you're getting the hot spots, the glory holes. And I'm hoping the LIDAR will give us a bit of an indication of that. And if we get those intersecting structures agreeing with some of the highs we get in the soils or some of the other high grab samples, then I think we're away for the races as far as understanding the morphology of the mineralization.
Very good. Now, a few months ago, you delivered an RNS saying there was a deal on the cards and there was one coming soon.
Yeah, well, Christmas is coming too.
Well, we're waiting. Where is it?
Well, it's Christmas this year, Christmas next year. We're working on it. Don't have any doubt about that. We're working on it.
Yeah, Santa's okay. Still coming.
And obviously, you're not going to tell us which asset it is, but we've just talked about it, I presume, in one in the last period of time.
Well, we didn't talk about ESSA.
Yeah.
And that's even closer to Hemlo.
Okay.
Yeah, and obviously, and alongside the field progress, James, First Class has also announced a strategic MOU with Valerium to explore tokenized funding models for project-level financing. This non-dilutive framework would use regulated digital asset technology to open access for global investors, issue compliant security-backed token via SPVs, and align with ESG-focused capital trends in a real-world asset tokenization. It is the first time a UK-listed exploration company has attempted to integrate regulated tokenization into early stage mining finance, and both teams see it as a potential step change in how mineral projects are funded and advanced. So I'm just trying to sort of like understand in simple layman's terms. Am I right in saying that First Class Metals and Valerium are looking at a modern way of raising money for exploration without issuing, you know, more shares and potentially diluting existing investors? And instead of going back to the market for equity, they create a separate SPV, or, you know, project vehicle, and then issue digital tokens that represent a small slice of that project. I guess a bit like selling tickets that give investors exposure to the future value of the mine rather than owning the whole company. Is that a fair summation?
I think that's a really good summary, Phil. In effect, you're correct. We will create an SPV, which will be a de facto joint venture. So the tokenization funding would assume the position of a joint venture partner, but without perhaps the noise. So FCM will continue to operate the project, deliver the project, but the financial benefits will be split at project level rather than at PLC level. So yeah, the whole idea is it will stop dilution at PLC level, fund the project for what we need from the bottom up, one would hope deliver a good return to all the parties.
Yeah, and if the project advances in any way or ultimately produces metal, I guess the value of those tokens would reflect that. So investors get a way to get to back the early stage exploration, and then the company gets the funding without issuing.
Investors would have a liquid platform where they could be traded upon until the point of a potential extraction, which could be a sale to a major company or similar. So yeah, if we could pull this off, it's a cracking system, and it really does.
Something I believe that Tether is involved with in these real world asset tokenization, and they're absolutely massive. I think their well known stablecoin is that USDT, and that's tied 1-to-1 to fiat currency. And they also offer the asset backed tokens, I think it's the Tether Gold, and that represents ownership. So this is being done on obviously a massive scale over in the US.
Yeah, RWAs are kind of, they've been around for a few years. I think acceptance in 2025 has become more mainstream. Central governments are backing them and authorising them. I think what you see is 2026, real world assets will be an explosion into mainstream, which will take centralised finance to decentralised finance across not just our industry, but
yeah.
Several
yeah, they're not actually do it tokenizing the individual mining projects like you are, so you're unique in that
exactly,
sense.
Yeah, ours is right at the base level, which
and I guess the next question is, would this include existing projects, or is this going to be new projects that you'll bring into tokenization potentially?
Well, at the moment, obviously we're reviewing the existing projects we have for suitability and financing, but if we're successful with the model, we have an incubator process, it would fit new projects coming through as well. So yeah, it would bring others on stream if we're successful with this process currently.
Yeah, I see gold playing a huge part in this blockchain situation, regardless of how it works, whether it's from you know, literally getting it from the ground, which is in this situation, or just even gold as you bring it out the ground to actually be tokenized in some way. Do you not think you should change your name, guys? You should be called Gold Class Metals, not First Class Metals. So I've got North Hemlo Gold, we've got Sunbeam Gold, we've got Kerr's Gold. Yes, we have Zigzag, but really that's on the back burner now. So, yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I spoke with Gary actually during the last week, I think it was, in Valerium, regarding you guys as well. Tried to get him on, but he was unavailable, unfortunately. So I think it's a fantastic situation, and I think there's such a pool of capital there that could be attracted into resource plays. I was saying it on one of the podcasts this week that I think it was about 25 years ago, there was about 8 or 9% of the value of the S&P 500 was in resource stocks. It's now less than 1%. Now, how can that be the case when we're in a real world situation where every single tech situation needs resource, whether it needs copper, it needs gold, it needs silver? I mean, we've seen what's been happening with silver going up to $62 an ounce. Gold, I'm sure, is going to go again. They're all predicting 5,000. They were all wrong last year. I think they'll all be wrong again next year because it'll probably be more like 6,000, not 5. But yeah, what are your thoughts on? I think we're at the beginnings of a resource super cycle. It's only just begun.
Well, I don't think at our level we can say we're in any sort of cycle. We're still in the doldrums until that money starts filtering down to the small cap explorer level. Then everyone's still struggling. I mean, okay, we had a really good day yesterday on the market. Our share price went up. We put out the press release about the drilling at North Hemlo. We were up 20-odd, nearly 30%. We're down today.
So I think that's where the opportunity potentially lies. The big gold companies, the gold price itself has really motored up. Junior resource companies focus on gold. We're still, I would say, across the board at the levels we've seen this last 5 years. So there's definitely some sort of a shift needed to rebalance the.
Yeah, there's a huge arbitrage there in terms of the bigger gold plays that have done very well, but they still haven't even done as well as they should have done.
No,
ultimately. But the issue is they're digging the stuff out the ground. They've got to replace those ounces somehow.
Well,
so how are they going to replace those ounces?
Yeah, you're right. And historically, what's happened is when the mid-tier producers start to have significant cash reserves, shall we say, or have optimistic upside, that's when they start to approach people like us as their de facto exploration arm.
Yeah, that's when M&A starts, for sure.
They can either sort of look over the fence and say, our neighbour's early stage, but we really like the look of that and it's close enough to our pit, or they think this could be a mine in the future, we'll get into this company. It takes a long time before the likes of your Barrick start investing in the small caps, but the mid-tiers are more likely once they feel confident about it, this cycle having legs, in other words.
Yeah. No, I think the cycle's got legs. I think we've got another 10 years ahead of us, and it's just that it's very hard to be positive after the last 3 or 4 years in the resource sector. It's been horrendous, you know, whether you like it or not. But we are starting to see shoots. And, you know, I mean, a good example of that would be Greatland Gold. You know, Greatland Gold is now, through Telfer, is now coughing off literally $100 million every month, pretty much. So by the summer, maybe they will have maybe 750 million, which will basically mean they don't have to borrow a single penny to do their asset in Australia. What's then going to happen with all the other cash flow that's kicked off is exactly what you've just said. They're going to start looking around as a medium-sized gold producer at all the other assets around them. And you guys are going to probably be in the same situation, I would imagine. I mean, Hemlo Mining Corporation hasn't spent $1.8 billion just for a bit of fun, I would imagine.
No, exactly.
You know, so you guys are right in the right place, and I think at the right time, even though I fully agree with you, the last few years, you guys have gone through bloody nightmare, let's be honest.
Yeah,
that's all right.
Now, don't lie about that, Mark. I'm grey as well. You were grey long before I started talking to you.
Yeah.
Indeed. Okay. Well, I genuinely think you need to think about changing your name to Gold Class Metals, because you are quite obviously going to be a gold explorer. And, you know, the amount of opportunity you've got in terms of ounces in the ground, even from Kerr's, the likelihood is a dead otter. And Sunbeam, you know, with your 200,000 ounces at above 3 grams with a 2 gram cutoff, you know, this is all worth significantly more than 5 million market capitalization, even in its current state.
Yeah, I would agree. I think every project we have, Kevin, would stand alone as a flagship for a company listed on a junior market. So, yeah, it's certainly a point to be envious of.
You could look at it from another point of view, and I'm sure there's a lot of small exploration companies out there who would say the same thing. But what was it, 2 years ago, our share price was 10 times what it is now. And in the last 2 years, we've drilled Zigzag successfully. We've now drilled North Hemlow visually successfully. We've brought Sunbeam on strides. We've advanced, we've acquired Kerr's. So when you think of what we've achieved in 2 years, and we're a tenth of the share price, it's almost a joke.
Yeah, and you've got a deal that you're going to do, which you're not telling us about, and you've got tokenization with Valerium. So
we got a deal. We did not tell you. We told you we got a deal.
No, but you're not telling us the details is what I mean. But there you go. You can't tell us the details. I understand the NDA, et cetera, et cetera. But let's hope that's going to be a game changer. And I think it will be. Hence the reason why you were smiling when you first introduced it. But yeah, good luck. Keep working hard. I mean, I think the one thing that we can see, Mark, as you said before, I think it was before the podcast, you've been to Canada every month this year. You know, you're continuing to do the hard yards on the ground. That is going to bring value, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm feeling tired, but in a good place, shall we say. There's good news coming.
It's great to catch up with you guys, and we thank you for coming on. So we'll say Mark Sale and James Knowles from First Class Metals, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast again.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, guys.
So let's move on to our movers and shakers of the week. The best mover I see is Eco Atlantic, up some 75% after they entered a strategic partnership with Navitas Petroleum under a binding framework and options agreement covering the Orinduik block offshore Guyana. Basically, they're these upfront for exclusive options that could see it acquire operatorship and up to 80% of Orinduik for $2.5 million, and up to 47.5% of Block 1 CBK for $4 million, while carrying Eco's exploration and appraisal costs subject to caps and repayment for future production. So, looks like a nice deal there. Eco describes it as transformational and expected to accelerate exploration, appraisal, and potential commercialization across its offshore Atlantic portfolio. So, yeah, Guyana. And then Clean Power Hydrogen up some 70% as well. The biggest shaker of the week, Kev, Premier African Minerals, PREM, down some 50%. They provided a corporate and funding update confirming that it raised around £500,000 in interim financing to support essential operations at Zulu Lithium, but still requires further funding to meet Phase 5 pre-production readiness costs and outstanding creditor obligations, with total group liabilities of approximately $62.1 million as at 30th of November, including significant amounts owed under its offtake prepayments arrangements, ongoing discussions with a major contractor creditor seeking payment of up to $2.3 million, and warning that failure to secure additional financing and extensions to existing agreements could have a material adverse impact on the business and cast doubt over the group's ability to continue as a going concern. So what do we make of that one? It's a very high-risk situation for Prem.
I feel it's like, you know, your dog that is very, very ill and you need to go to the vet and put it down. That's what it feels like. I think it's virtually got no chance, less than 1% of survival. And even if it does survive with the lithium prices, how's it going to do anything? You know, it's been teetering on the verge of disaster for a year or two now. And I think for everybody's sake, it might be better if it just is, they put it down.
Yeah. It's all down to that, whether they can sort this balance sheet out, isn't it? Whether they can secure this meaningful follow up funding, and then negotiate, you know, extensions with that offtake partner, and stabilize any pressures. But that's a large liability.
Yeah, I think Charles has said in the past that that asset is just going to get taken by the creditors, and that is the offtake partner, and then they're going to use it. Simple as that. I don't think there's any way back, but you never know. You never know.
Okay. And then Ajax Resources had a good week, didn't they? We talked to Ippolito there regarding the Appian investment that came in. Was it $400,000? And obviously they had a fundraise that was announced on Thursday as well on the back of that. Just tell us a little bit about Ajax and what you make of it. It's a relatively new company that's come onto our radar.
Yeah, South American focused. And rather than me speak, I think the best thing to do is let Ippo tell us. So we'll take a small amount from the interview that we did and let you have a listen.
Appian, believing in the story, that helps a lot. The names on your shareholder register, most people in this space will know, if not personally, they'll know who they are. But we've gone into quite a lot of detail. For people, you know, a lot of people listening to this podcast won't know Ajax and won't know the story. So if we take a step back for a couple of minutes and say, right, Ippolito, you're the CEO, you're the largest shareholder, what's the elevator pitch? If you've got a couple of minutes, say, you know, there's hundreds of junior resource stocks out there. There's quite a few on that quiz. There's, you know, dozens on AIM.
Yeah.
Why would someone invest in Ajax Resources over anybody else?
Yeah, sure. So why invest in Ajax? We're a 5 million market cap natural resource investment company with a portfolio of 4 projects that we've signed binding terms for, which we're currently doing DD on before completing. So they're binding on the seller, but not on Ajax. So if we find something we don't like, we can always opt out, but we've done a bit of preventive DD, so we know that they're good projects. We have a very compact shareholder register, so the board has in excess of 30% of the share capital of the business. The rest of the TR1 holders are, you know, high net worth or ultra high net worth individuals, or small institutions, or even, as we have today, a very large institution in Appian. In fact, I think we're probably one of the only London-listed, UK-listed companies that has Appian as a shareholder. So we're very fortunate in that. And we're exposed, you know, we have projects which all have or will shortly have quantifiable JORC-compliant resource estimates. So, and these are not, you know, unfashionable metals. They're the most trending metals that you can have at the moment, which are gold, copper, silver, and, well, to a lesser degree, zinc, which is a metal I like very much, but it doesn't have the excitement of gold and copper. And so we're potentially a near-term producer. And we have a focus on developing assets, but also engaging in exploration. So you have the excitement of the exploration, and then the revenue, the numbers, the stability offered by revenue generation. So, yeah, I think Ajax is quite unique. I think you'll find that, you know, as a board, we didn't have any remuneration until we completed our first deal in May. I struggled to find any other company that had directors who didn't take any remuneration for 3 years. And we also are the largest shareholders in the business, which, again, I think is quite rare. And of course, there are other companies where the directors have large positions, but not really that common. Most directors are
skin in the game, isn't it?
Yeah, most directors are employees or kind of consultants who tend to have a rather mercenary approach of, you know, moving from one company to another after a set period of time. Not the case here. We want to get Ajax to, you know, 50 million, 100 million market cap, and then beyond, hopefully. So it's interesting. Appian as a fund, it's an extraordinary fund because, you know, in working with them, I've been able to study their history and understand how, you know, how they became what they are today. And, you know, they were telling me, you know, only a few years ago, they were a much smaller fund. And if you go on their website, there's some very nice documentary they've put together of how, you know, how Appian became what it is today. And it's extraordinary how obviously now they're a multi-5 billion plus hedge fund. But these things can move quickly if you do the right things and you surround yourself with the right people and you're motivated. So I'm not saying we're going to get to 5 billion. I think that's quite presumptuous. But why not
try it?
Yeah. Why not try? Exactly. So that's, I think, to conclude my over 5 minute elevator pitch, I think what shareholders have in Ajax is a company which is extremely driven. And I think the number of acquisitions we've announced in the last few months and the terms we've secured is evidence of that.
What would you say? There's a very good elevator pitch. But then obviously the next follow-up question is, what would you say? Is there a flagship in this company? Or if there's not a flagship, is there a project that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I think Eureka would be the deal of the century if we get it right, because for $170,000 after what Bezant paid in 2010, and bear in mind, copper and gold has only increased since 2010, we're able to define an exciting MRE on that, and then we're only drilling a small part of the project. So and we've doubled the size of Eureka since buying it back in May. We've acquired a number of promising contiguous licenses. So if we get that right, that in itself would be a masterstroke of deal making. So that would be very exciting, and there's pretty minimal downside, because $170,000 is, we have no doubt that we would be able to, even in the very worst case scenario, we would recover our investment. So that would be a project that, and it's our first acquisition, so we're quite, I guess, attached to that project. But again, I sometimes am asked, would you sell Eureka if a large company came and you realize the potential, and then a large company came and offered to buy it? And the answer is, of course we would. We're not, I think the most dangerous thing a management team can do is to fall in love with projects and continue raising money and believing in those projects. And perhaps, sometimes you have companies that the results are not quite what they want, and they continue to drill, continue to spend money. I think you need to have a kind of more generalist approach and focus on what works and what doesn't work. So, and when things do work, you need to know when to sell them, because being a producer has a whole host of challenges,
Indeed,
which
well,
exploration companies don't have. So we're building a portfolio for that reason. And if we can sell projects on very advantageous terms, just as we bought them on very advantageous terms, then of course we will. But I think in terms of the valuation, yeah, I mean, obviously there's no point. You get some CEOs who say all sorts of nonsense on these podcasts, not on your podcast, but on other rival podcasts. They say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. I'm not going to say that. But the reality is that we want to get to 50 million. That's our first milestone. I think 30 would be a good milestone, because that's the minimum market cap to be listed on the main market, which is the market we've just come off as a shell. So that, I think, is our first milestone, get to 30 million, which is perfectly achievable if we deliver, and then scale up from there. I mean, a company I like very much, which I had the fortune of meeting some, well, the CEO and some of the other people behind it, is Amaroq Minerals in Greenland. And they've got a similar
Don't
strategy
talk
to
to
ours.
don't talk to Charles about that. It's one of his favourites.
Oh, really?
Been in the early year.
I'm a big fan of Amaroq. I
I was
like
speaking to
Amaroq,
their
and
geologist team earlier today.
oh,
Sorry,
really? Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
I'm
So,
not going to plug. I'm not going to plug,
no, I'm a big
but.
fan of theirs. So that what they've done with their Greenland. In fact, I was looking at that mine that they acquired, the Black Angel mine. It was a great project there, but unfortunately, it was too small back in the day to bid for that one. But the it was what they've done is being a producer, right, and being a gold producer in a tier one jurisdiction, and buying assets that formerly produced and bringing them back to life. So not too dissimilar from, well, in fact, exactly the same as our strategy. So they've got, I think, a 400 million, three, just I think they may have a bit less, perhaps 300 to 400 million valuation. And they've done, Eldar, the CEO, he's done an exceptional job. And he's taken that company from, I think, a 10 million market valuation to where it is today. So he's a bit older than me, slightly older than me, but maybe 5 or 6 years, quite young. So why not? He's a smart guy, and he's got a great technical team and a great team around him. But the idea will be to try and, as much as we can, to try and replicate what Amaroq did in a different jurisdiction, albeit.
Yeah, I compare you very much actually to a different company, which is Guardian Metal Resources with Oliver Friesen. I think you're young, you're very insistent on proving that you can make this happen, and we wish you luck along the way. But we will do a more in-depth in the project at another time. But today was all about reviewing the situation. You literally have billions of dollars of resource in the ground. All you got to do is prove them up to the point where you can produce them. And yeah, I think you'll be fine with your 30 million, 50 million, etc. And if one of them literally does have a eureka moment, then you'll be worth hundreds of millions.
Yeah, well, that's the goal. That's what we're working towards every day. So thank you for your kind words, and hopefully we'll be able to start delivering that in the new year.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you make of it, Kev? As you say, South American focused, Eureka asset there that they bought at what could potentially be a bargain price from Bazant, other assets that they talked about, that the Leon and another asset
Well,
in there.
let me just give you the numbers, okay? And people can decide themselves. Right, we've got the Eureka project, 620,000 tons of contained copper, 52,000 ounces of gold, and this is Pagua Anta, which is 265 million pounds of zinc. That seems like a lot of zinc, and 74 million pounds of lead. Then we go on to the Leon project, also JORC compliant. So, in other words, it's there. 40,920 tons of contained copper,
3.82 million ounces of silver. So there's over 10 million ounces of silver just in those things. Then we've got Piera Veloa. This is non-JORC compliant because it didn't specify for the issues in the JORC handbook, if you like. But we believe it's there. 110,000 ounces of gold. And this is the Appian in-house estimate. So effectively, that Appian, if you don't know about them, $5 billion company that effectively does all sorts of resource plays. And they tend to only do very, very big ones. And they seem to have picked Ajax as, I keep wanting to say Ajax, because that's basically how you...
Yeah, I was thinking about the football team Ajax, but it is Ajax, because remember Ajax is the cleaning agent in that metal sort of container, Ajax, it's the same as that.
Yeah, yeah. But it's spelled the same as Ajax, no, the football
team. Yeah, 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 it's the same spelling, yeah. But it's just how you pronounce it.
Yeah, so they've got 110,000 ounces of gold. Appian, huge, huge company that only wants effectively huge tier one. Seems to be that they've created a connection now with Ajax that, you know, if they come across other product, other deals that they like but are not big enough for them to go themselves, then this could now start to be a deal-making situation. Appian have bought into the raise as well. I think it's going to be one that we follow over the next few years. I think it's very exciting. That much metal in ground is literally worth billions. I mean, I don't mean 1 billion. I mean several billion dollars. So even a very tiny proportion of that is going to make.
So do you see this as being almost like the sort of with the project royalty / incubator model, where they take a project, they do some drilling, they do the info, you do the usual, prove up, add the resources, inferred, indicative, and all that. And then they maybe say sell it on for 20 million or 20x.
No, I don't see that. I see that he wants to go to production in these things. So I think it's going to be slightly different. What I see is GMET here. I mean, we've got a young, excited CEO who knows his stuff and wants to make this happen. He speaks Spanish, he speaks Italian. You know, he's in South America for that reason, because of the Spanish. So I think it's got massive potential. And, you know, these aren't exploration assets. These are JORC qualified assets that he's already got. And he's managed to get them for really buttons, to be honest with you. He's got them for buttons. And, good luck to him. I think his goal now is to have it as a 50 million market cap. It's going to be sitting around £6 or 7 million market cap at the minute. Yeah, I mean, and then he even was bold enough to say he wants it to be a £1 billion company. So that's obviously a long way from here, but I think 50 million over the next 12 to 18 months is more than possible once some of these things are proved up, because there is real value. And it may be, your point could come to it, that maybe they sacrifice one of these to sell the asset or sell it and let someone else put the cash in, so that they can be in a situation where they can advance the other ones much faster. It's possible. But yeah, it's an exciting proposition. But we also heard from Aterion. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think Aterion's extremely exciting. That AI thing with all their licenses in Morocco and Botswana. It's exploration. So it's a step down, if you like, from Ajax, but the reality is I'm extremely excited about Aterion, because it's very lowly valued. They finally get the trading right this coming year. It's going to be self-sufficient, and they're going to find some stuff. That's a company backed by some serious players who want to find some stuff. So yeah, and then we've got the gold in the first class metals as well. I mean, as I said jokingly, it should be called gold class metals, because, you know, they've got three pretty good gold projects there that, you know, should be valued far, far higher just on the gold estimates that they've got. So, yeah, very interesting.
Definitely looks good. So present resources Monday, result of general meeting there regarding the 90% shareholding in the Mid Lab and Zinc Mining. Was obviously all passing all resolutions, which is good. Good news on that one.
Bazant Resources, first of all, full steam ahead. Everything's passed. We're ready to rock and roll. I think within 6 to 9 months, there's going to be copper and gold coming out of the ground. And we're currently worth 2 pennies and a banana. And actually, we should be worth at least 5 pennies and 20 bananas. You know, that's the reality of the situation. If you want to read something, read Charles's article on Bazant in terms of the potential. Definitely got the potential to go up to 90% and probably 100% of the project. There's also tax write-offs there because it's been worked upon for a long, long time in Hope and Gorup. So you could see the first couple of years, basically tax-free income of, I think, 30. I think he increased them all, and the first 2 years production could net a $62 million profit or free cash flow, let's say, for the sake of argument. So if you just value it on that alone, 62 million is about, what, 45 million pounds, between 45 and 50 million pounds. And we've currently got a market cap of about 12. So that doesn't make any sense in anybody's books.
Yeah, so we also saw news from eStar this week, which I know is one that you've been following the story of, that they announced a binding heads of agreement with Hong Kong Xinhai Mining Services to form a JV to develop the Vakuba copper deposit in Kazakhstan, under which Xinhai will fund all drilling, feasibility, engineering, construction, commissioning costs, estimated at around $65 million, to earn up to a 70% interest and operatorship in stages, taking the project through to production, while eStar will retain a 30% carried interest at commissioning with no further funding required, and continues to hold 100% of its other copper and gold assets, including the Rulika and Talevyuskoy prospects. So, Kev, great news on that one. Free carry of 30%, obviously a lot of costs there paid for by Xinhai, $65 million. Just talk us through some of the assets and how big Vakuba is in terms of, you know, in-situ metals.
Yeah, it's about half a million tons of contained copper, I think, roughly. It could be a little bit more. On drilling, it's probably likely to be more, to be honest, because it hasn't been completely drilled out. So, but the way these Chinese guys are going to do it, they're not going to spend a huge amount drilling out. They're going to dig it out and basically accept that, you know, the current situation is the current situation. Look, on the current copper prices at a 40% margin, basically 10,000 tons per annum starting in 2027, late 27, 28. There's going to be $110 million of resource coming out of the ground after process. So 40% of that is $44 million a year. eStar are on 30% of that $44 million. So they're going to be getting $13.2 million per annum. Or at current exchange rate, what's that? 9 to 10 million pounds a year. So they're on 9 to 10 million pounds a year, free carry, don't have to put another penny in the ground. And they've got a whole load more of these VMS structures that, you know, once this happens once, it's going to happen again. You know, so in other words, once the free cash flow starts, they're going to then have the situation to be able to do this again and again and again. Now, the other one that they found is a similar size, I think, and maybe even slightly bigger. But let's assume 10,000 again. That would be another $9 million or £9 million a year of profit. So you're talking about a company that potentially within 3 to 4 years could have £18 million a year profit just on those two assets. It's also got massive other assets as well. I think just while we were on here, I think it hit 4p. It's valued at not very much. I think it's about 13 or 14 million pounds at 4p. Massively undervalued, massively. And I have said it, if you look back on the podcast in the past, I've said that Vakuba is going to be worth a lot more money. Alex Walker did an interview with Crux, and I watched it yesterday, and he was flabbergasted how good the deal was, and I am as well. I think a 30% free carry on Vakuba all the way to production and onward is just immense. I mean, really, how is this not worth, you know, 10p right now? I don't know. I really don't know, because it is fantastic. And on top of that, you've then got all the other assets they've got, which should be valued. I mean, I can see this next year being worth 20, 30, 40p easily. Yeah.
Okay, good. That sounds very exciting. And then we got Greenrock Strategic Materials, GROK. They secured a major milestone after the government of Greenland granted a 30-year exploitation license for the Amitsoq Graphite project to its wholly owned subsidiary, Greenland Graphite, following rapid regulatory approval and the Greenland's revised Mining Act, paving the way for long-term graphite production at Amitsoq and positioning the project as a potential strategic source of critical mineral for Europe's energy transition. So great news for Greenrock as well. It's good to see Stefan there with in the photos with the government. And then Incantera as well, Kev, they had a announcement there. They reported the interim results for the 6 months to 30th of September, highlighting the global launch of the Skin and Cell skincare range via direct consumer DTC website, continued investment in DTC infrastructure and marketing, and steadily improving online traction and sales since launch, alongside ongoing discussions with multiple parties to develop additional routes to market beyond DTC, which the company says could further support commercial growth. So nice to see interim results from them. Anything else on the radar, Kev, this week?
Cobra Resources, one of our
Yep.
picks this year. It's actually leading the way at the minute. Lots of good
Yes, that's my pick.
stuff. Yeah, it's 4.5p was picked at 1.15p, so up considerable amount since we began. It's
Did you see what the
closed
update was? Did you, it was this
closing on
the
300%. No, I didn't get to the fine details, so if you've got the update there, go for it.
Yeah, it was about the metallurgical optimization. They put an update, I think it was out on the Wednesday, and they basically reported a major metallurgical optimization breakthrough at the Boland In-Situ Recovery Rare Earths project in South Australia, with ANSTO test work demonstrating the removal of 100% of low-value cerium from the pregnant liquor solution at ambient conditions, while retaining high-value magnet and heavy rare earths, upgrading the potential mixed rare earth carbonate value by around 50%, significantly enriching dysprosium, terbium, neodymium, and praseodymium content, simplifying downstream processing and enabling cerium carbonate to be sold as separate byproduct as Cobra now updates its process flow sheet and positions Boland as a low-cost, environmentally attractive source of critical heavy rare earths for electrification markets. So basically a 50% uptick or valuation in the upgrade on that mixed rare earth carbonate, this byproduct that they're going to be basically selling on there. Yeah, what do you make of that news?
Yeah, it's very good. I mean, it's going to be the next few years are going to be critical metals, aren't they? And this is one of them. It's got a low cost production of this stuff that rare earths that are needed for the magnets and for other things in industry. I can't see how it's not going to continue. Still not a huge market cap. And yeah, I think it's going to do well going through next year as well.
GreenX also had news on Friday that they'd completed the acquisition of a 90% interest in the Tannenberg copper project in Germany after exercising the option over Group 11 exploration, securing control of an expanded 1,900 square kilometers license package in a historically productive low-risk mining region. Work completed in 2025 has validated high-grade copper and silver mineralization from historical drilling, including non-JORC historical estimates of 728,000 tons of contained copper at 2.6% copper, and later drilling showing 2.1% copper plus 25 grams per ton of silver, with modern re-assaying confirming thicker mineralized intervals and district scale potential. So really, really interesting upgrade in the actual acquisition of the 90% interest, bigger area, and looks like good numbers on the contained copper as well.
Yeah, I mean, we visited the site. Obviously, we know that it was a effectively German army Nazi thing that was created in the late 1930s, I think, and into the 1940s. It's there. I'm pretty sure they were, they'd sunk the shafts. They were going to be digging it out. The interesting thing is that the JORC resources are all based on the thin layer of copper that was there, which was only about, I think, 12 to 24 inches. Whereas they have now discovered, after more analysis, that it's the whole shale area, which is more like
8 to 10 meters. So there's actually a lot more copper there than even they realized at that time in the 30s and 40s. So yeah, I think it's going to be a mega project. It's going to be massive. Okay.
Let's move on to just the wider markets. We saw on the 10th of December, the US Fed Reserve cutting interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point. Bit of a split among Fed officials about the decision. General outlook now is that they might only do one more cut next year. Obviously, we saw gold prices jump to a one-month high right after the announcement, which is a pretty common reaction as we've seen rates go down and investors look for safe havens. And then obviously silver, as you alluded to there, unbelievable punch through the 60s. You know, it's currently, I'm looking right now, it's at 64.425, close to its record. It is the record low, certainly close to the record highs of around 64.3. A few factors pushing silver up, been a lot of industrial demand, some tightness in supply, and the US recently designating silver as a critical mineral, which is giving it a more strategic importance. So what do you make of silver, Kev? It's the gift that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah, I think we've only just begun, guys. So don't think you've missed it, because I don't think you've missed it at all. I mean, the high now is $64.70. I think I'll put my head on the line again, or my neck on the line again. I think silver is going to touch $200 an ounce within 18 to 24 months. That's what I think is going to happen. And why? I will go on my rant again. Effectively, there isn't enough of it, for one. Secondly, we're in a situation where nobody has been mining it intensely for a long time. It's always, you know, there's copper and there's some silver, there's gold and there's some silver. So it's a byproduct of what's coming out the ground. The other scenario is that there is not enough of it each year. There is now a deficit in terms of a running deficit. And the other thing why I think the share price is going to, or not the share price, but the price of silver is going to keep going up, is because we have a futures market that is 100 to 1 compared to the actual physical silver. So what happened a week ago and why we're seeing this happening now is that somebody said they wanted 400 million ounces of silver from a contract and they wanted delivery at the end of December. Now, the total production of silver in the whole world is 850,000 or 850 million ounces a year.
Yeah.
So if someone asked for just under 50% of the whole of the production of the world in silver by the end of the year.
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
There's not enough. I mean, it's a massive deficit. There's not enough. As you say, we've talked about this before. It's not the production. It's the processing, isn't it? It's the processing issues.
Yeah. Well, there is enough silver out there in the world, but nobody's actually mining it. So therefore, it's a byproduct. And in most cases, there are some silver mines, obviously. And I'm telling you now, in 5 years' time, there's going to be a lot more silver mines because people are going to just mine for the silver.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at $200 silver, then what does that contribute to the companies that we're talking about? You know, Ajax is a good example. I told you there was more than 10 million ounces of JORC silver in that Ajax situation. As it stands at the minute, that's worth $6.4 billion in ground.
Yeah.
You've got GMET. GMET has 6.6 million at Pilot Mountain, which is about to be increased because of all the drilling they've done. So that is worth that's worth about £4 billion now, maybe more, right? Yeah, you've got Bazan, exactly the same. They've got X amount in the ground, and it's worth more. Even those figures Charles did, he quotes silver at $52. It's now $64. And gold the same. I see gold at 5,000 within the next couple of months. Yeah. And I see silver escalating. What's happened to this ratio is that the ratio of gold to silver was over 100. It then started to drop. It's now 1 to 67 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
it needs to drop to 1 to 40, 1 to 50.
See, I was listening to an analyst this week, though, and she was saying that when the gold-silver ratio is around between 85 to 100, it means silver is cheap and it's undervalued and it's a buy, screaming buy. But when it drops to 70 to 65 to 70 area, silver is a sell because it's overvalued. And I was trying to look through all the historics, and we've talked about them. Like, you know, sometimes historically it's been as low as 15, 20, to one, you know, the average is probably around 40, 50 to one. But I was amazed that she was saying, no, it's a sell at 65 to 70 to one because silver's overvalued in relative terms. I was like, not sure that I've ever heard.
No chance. And look what India did. India have brought in lending against precious metals, and they've brought in a ratio of gold to silver. So if you bring in your silver and gold together, you get a ratio of what you can lend, and that ratio is 1 to 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Historically, like literally going back millennia or centuries, you know, the gold ratio was 1 to 10, 1 to 12, 1 to 15, and not much higher than that. Now, I think in modern day times, we could be looking at a ratio of 1 to 25 to 1 to 30, something like that, would be a normal ratio. Now, if that is the case, then what are we looking at for silver now at 1 to 25? You know, a $5,000 gold, 1 to 25 is what, $200 silver?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting times, that's for sure. And even, as you say, you know, not just silver, gold, but, you know, you look at copper as well. Copper trading around 5.4725 right now as we speak, which is really good. Really, really strong as well. So yeah, great to see. Moving on a little bit swiftly, because obviously, you know, conscious of time. Champions League, a lot of drama for the English clubs. Chelsea stumbling, tough loss at Atalanta. We saw Tottenham cruise past Slavia Prague 3-0. Arsenal picked up a 3-0 win over Club Bruges, and City managed a notable 2-1 victory against Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. So a pretty good week for English teams, despite Chelsea's hiccup. And then also, Kev, moving on to, we've talked about this for the last few weeks, Lando Norris, big congratulations. Coached his first Formula One World Championship, wrapped it up at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix and edged out Max Verstappen by just 2 points in the standings. Massive achievement for Lando and McLaren as well. And it makes him the 11th British driver to ever win the title, and one of only 35 drivers ever to be crowned Formula One World Champion. So congrats, Lando, on that one. What a season.
Yeah, what a season. Do you know what? Since these American boys have taken over Formula One, it's getting a bit more exciting. They're changing the rules so that, you know, people can overtake and all those things. Yeah, good old Liverpool won in the San Siro. Can't complain about that. 1-0. Absolute ridiculous penalty, but we shouldn't have had a goal disallowed in the first half. So what comes around goes around. So all tremendous stuff. Salah threw his toys out the pram, and yeah, hopefully that rectifies itself. Either that or Salah's on his way to Saudi Arabia for £100 million. We will see. We will see. Hopefully there's going to be some talk about that in the near future. And hopefully this toys out the pram incident is actually going to bring the team together and we're going to start performing again. That's what I'm hopeful for, because it's definitely had to solidify them and say, you know, we're a team here. Let's get on with it. So, yeah, let's see what happens. Who are the playing this weekend? We've got Arsenal against Wolves, I think, which should be 3 points for Arsenal. But Arsenal are only 2 points behind, or Man City are only 2 points behind Arsenal now. So we've got Chelsea against Everton. We've got Liverpool against Brighton, Burnley, Fulham, Arsenal against Wolves is the late Saturday kickoff. You will know the results of that by now. And then Crystal Palace against City, Forest against Spurs, Sunderland against Newcastle, West Ham against Arsenal, Brentford against Leeds, and then the mighty United on Monday against Bournemouth.
Yeah, Bournemouth.
It's basically Aston Villa have been amazing, haven't they? They've won like 9 on the run, I think, having had a disastrous start. And they've got West Ham. There's a good chance they could win that. Difficult game for Manchester City against Crystal Palace, because they've been playing well, especially at home.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be interesting. We thought Arsenal were running away with it, but it doesn't look like it anymore. So, but they've been amazing in the Champions League. six out of six, isn't it? So, yeah, they're looking good.
Yeah. Don't know, mate. I think it's, as you say, wide open. I wouldn't want to, because anything can happen. The Premier League, it never fails to disappoint. So if you enjoyed the chat and want to stay in the loop, definitely hit subscribe and tap that bell icon so you never miss an update. Really appreciate you being here, and we'll catch you next time for more news and stories. Thanks for listening and have a fantastic weekend.
Yep, thanks. And look out for our podcasts over Christmas, where we're going to be talking about our picks for 2026 and also picks in different resource areas as well.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net